Do you remember how in the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, there was always muzak piped through the institution? 101 strings play for the crazies? Different music and a different approach to music has entered institutions now through music therapy. The power of music to communicate, to stimulate and exhilarate, is nothing new, but it's only recently, in about the past 30 years, that these qualities of music, which we all recognize, have been used as a form of therapy. Music therapy is used now in practically every kind of setting for the handicapped or atypical individual. Children who do not use or comprehend language often respond strongly to music. The music in music therapy is not about soft and sweet and soothing melodies. They have their place in the sessions, but the music used is more often very powerful, dissonant chords, compelling rhythms. I'm in the studio now with Ken Brucia, a music therapist. Before we talk, I'd like you to hear an excerpt of a music therapy session. This is a session that is led by Edith Boxhill. It is one of the very few commercially available recordings of live music therapy. It's a Folkways recording for which Ken, my guest, was a consultant.
Now, we can clap.
Do that, Carl.
Everybody, this is a dance. And you can do it with your hands and feet. Clap, clap, clap,
heard some moments in a music therapy session that was conducted by Edith Boxhill and was transferred to a recording on the Folkways record label. We're going to be discussing the music therapy approach to music and to therapy with Ken Brucia. Ken is an associate professor at Temple University, where he is the coordinator of the music therapy program. Professionally, he started out as a performer, a classical piano soloist. He began working as a music therapist in the early 1970s. Ken, can you talk about why you made that transition from performer to music therapist?
Well, I suppose the first thing was that when I finished my studies in piano, I started teaching. And in teaching piano, I became very fascinated with how the students express themselves in their piano lessons. And as every piano teacher knows, when you teach piano, you also hear a lot of personal things coming from the students, and they tend to establish a very close and trusting relationship with you. And what I began to find out was that as I began to know the student more and more, I began to really understand how they played, and that I really saw that many of their limitations and many of their strengths on a personal level were absolutely manifest in the way they played, and that as a piano teacher, I couldn't just deal with, well, put your third finger here and your fifth finger here. I had to deal with, well, why isn't this person feeling this particular phrase, and what is it that they would interpret it in this way, so that you have to deal with the individual and the actual art or skill of playing. And that began to fascinate me so, and I began to see that, in a sense, musical behavior is just an extension of one's personality, and that that really fascinated me.
Well, to me, there's kind of a difference between music being an extension of a personality and thinking that through music somehow some kind of change or expansion within that personality can be developed. Is that a possibility with music therapy, that an individual can emotionally or physically develop or expand or experience more than they could have without it?
I think that's the key, in terms of experiencing more. I think what we find with people everyday people on the street, and also those people that are institutionalized, that what begins, that one of the dangers, I think, is that we have our experiences atrophied or closed in, and this is usually expressed in what we do. And so that musical behavior is not any kind of special kind of behavior or special kind of realm of experience that's different from just human experience and human behavior. And so that the basic premise of music therapy for me is that music is living. Music is human experience. There are no differences. And if one has limitations in the way one experiences their self and their world, then that will be manifest also in the way they make music or any art.
I think that a kind of typical feeling about therapy for specifically nonverbal children would be, well, what we have to do is give them language. You know, language is the main tool with which we communicate, and a human being is only half a human being without that language ability. Now, are you or are you not with music therapy trying to, you know, remotely develop verbal language, or are you working with a completely different approach to what communication is?
I think both, but I would say that the music therapist has a whole realm to explore in the area of communication that is unique to music, that man has in every culture expressed ideas, thoughts, feelings, and fantasies through music in a nonverbal way, and that it certainly must provide man some kind of unique experience that's different from language. Otherwise, every culture would not have music in addition to language. So that music as a communicative process is unique from language, but at the same time, it has a lot of the same elements as the language process. So that in music therapy, I think, especially with nonverbal children, emotionally disturbed children, you'll find that one of the main problems with a disturbed child is that they are not motivated to communicate. If they're not motivated to communicate, they're not going to develop language as we know it in terms of, you know, verbal talking and so forth. Somehow communication has not been a rewarding experience for them. And so in a sense, what has to be done with them is to completely remotivate them to say, there is something inside of me that I want to get out. And if I get out, somebody else out there receives it and understands it. With language, it's so difficult because if you haven't learned the game, it's very hard to receive and it's very hard to have a rewarding experience. Within music, you have so many possibilities to express yourself that it's a rewarding experience. And as soon as the other person picks up on those sounds and gives them back to you, of course, then the child is absolutely elated and wants then to express more and more and to communicate with that other person through this medium. On the other hand, music therapy can work very, very closely with speech therapy in terms of developing very specific skills, primarily because music overlaps with speech in terms of that it basically deals with sound, how sounds are organized, how sound becomes meaningful, and so that many times for the what we call the pre-verbal child, music is used to give them the kinds of perceptual and discriminating skills that they need to develop the ability to speak and to understand the spoken word. So it's both.
Now, we're not talking about taking nonverbal children and making them into concert musicians, right? I mean,
No. I guess one of the questions probably most asked is just what you've asked. Sometimes I think that our culture has developed an attitude towards music and musicianship that that they're this special lot of people and that they have these very special skills. Well, without denying that, at the same time, I maintain that every human being has the capacity to be musically expressive and to express feelings through music, and that it, you don't have to be a concert pianist to be able to use sound to express yourself. And so that down to the lowest levels of mental retardation, there can be expression and there can be the use of sound. So no, you don't have to impose some concept of musical ability on a client and say, well, if you can't play this rhythm absolutely correctly, then we know that you don't have musical ability. It's not the point.
When I first heard that there was a field that existed called music therapy, I immediately made all these categories and stereotypes of what went on there. And my first one was, well, I bet they give the children little triangles and have them tap, tap, tap along to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and all the songs that I learned to hate very quickly when I was young. And to my great surprise and pleasure, I mean, I found that some of the music, like the example that we just heard, is filled with interesting chords and rhythms. Can you talk a little bit about what kinds of music you use in your therapy and why?
Sure. I think probably the first thing a music therapist has to do is to form some kind of a musical picture in their own minds, in their own ears, of the child or the children that they are working with. And the kind of music that you would pick really is determined by the child. The child will tell you what kinds of instruments he likes if you just give him a chance to. And I don't mean that he's going to say, I want to play the triangle or whatever. He's going to go towards the triangle. He's going to show you the kinds of things he wants to do and the kinds of sounds he wants to make. Then I think that the job of the music therapist is taking what the child has shown you as to what his affinity is, that you then build sounds and melodies and harmonies around that child so that you engage the child. I think that probably the key word is that you choose music or you make it up, or you make it up around what the child is doing to engage that child in some kind of communication or interaction with you and with the sounds that he's making.
I'm interested in some of the dissonant qualities of the music that I think is used, at least sometimes used, in music therapy. I think usually songs that are written for children are very sweet and melodic and simple and different from the example that we just heard of the music therapy session. Is there a liberating quality for these children sometimes in the dissonant structures that are created?
Yes, I think that dissonances are important for a lot of reasons. The first two that pop into my head are that, one, our experience, our feelings, living in our life experiences, everything is not consonant. And we have to somehow incorporate into our experience dissonance. There are things that happen in life that are dissonant. And so, therefore, dissonances in music really depict our life experiences many times. The wonderful thing about dissonance in music is that you find some peace or some resolution or some consonance most of the time, if that's indicated. The other reason for dissonances is that dissonances are usually very engaging. They really capture the child. You can just see their eyes light up when they hear that dissonance. And remember, too, that within the group of children of emotional disturbance or autism or so forth, many times the dissonance is something that really is very depictive of their experience. That many of their experiences are that. And sometimes you use the dissonances to show that child that they're not alone in that kind of dissonant experience, and that we can take that dissonant experience elsewhere. There is an alternative to that dissonance.
Now, that's so different from the stereotype that I had initially had before I learned anything about this, which was that, you know, we, the sane people, would play sweet melodies for them and comfort these poor, isolated individuals. I think that what you said is interesting when applied to like contemporary music concerts. I know like a lot of people who show up for a concert and find themselves hit with all this dissonance and contemporary mm-hmm. chordal structure wonder where the beauty is. You know, it's a concert. You're supposed to give us beauty, and there's all this dissonance here.
The other thing, too, that's wonderful is that in working within a music therapy situation, as a musician, you have a wonderful freedom, because what you find is that all children, normal and handicapped, don't have the same cultural hang-ups until it's beaten into them. So they find dissonances engaging, but whether or not they really define them as dissonances, sometimes you don't really know that. And so that the concert goer who goes to a very modern concert or recital of very modern pieces, they say, well, it's dissonant. Well, it's only because of their background and their culture that they're saying that this is dissonant music. But within that music, it depends upon your perspective, it may be very consonant.
Ken, maybe what we should do now is listen back to the session that we opened this part of the discussion with, and perhaps before we hear it, you could tell us what Edith Boxall, who is conducting the music therapy session, is doing with her music and with the children, so we could, you know, visualize in our minds
okay.
what might be going on.
I think that the horror is that she does with these children is very illustrative of the most effective music therapy approach, and that is that you can hear at the beginning that she's first starting off with their speed. She's first starting off with their level of intensity, and she's trying to organize it. Many disturbed children and handicapped children have great difficulty in terms of organizing their world, the world that they hear, the world that they see outside, and also organizing their world inside. In a musical experience like what you will hear, the child has an opportunity to first perceive the order of what's going on outside. As they begin to become more active in the music, they begin to have to then organize their own life and produce then some kind of an organized response. As soon as that experience becomes organized, you start hearing her lead, and you start hearing her get faster and faster and faster, leading up to a higher level of intensity. The purpose for this is that music makes you live through an experience, and that by going through this experience and gradually growing in intensity, but yet organizing the whole thing, you learn how to control your experience in a sense, in yet the freest of ways. But things have order, and that you can experience feeling within a certain order, that the feeling can make sense, and that music makes you live through that feeling. So that it is ordered, and that you have a chance to not only order your inside, but also to clap in time with the rhythm and feel as if you are now consonant with what's going on outside. I think this is a perfect example of this approach.
Okay, let's hear this example. This is a music therapy session that was led by Edith Boxhill.
Now we can clap.
Do that, Paul.
A dance, and you can do it with your hands and feet.
Faster! That's how.
music therapy session led by Edith Boxhill, which was recorded on Folkways Records. I'm in the studio with Ken Brucia, who is the coordinator of the music therapy program at Temple University. He's an associate professor there. Ken, you had referred to music therapy as helping people through music to organize experience. Yes, is that?
Yes.
Now, I think a lot of approaches to therapy see therapy as helping to make children or adults or whomever normal. And what you're saying is very different than that.
I hope so. First, let me say that normality is for me, a statistical concept, and that for, quote, normals, what we've basically managed to do is to fit our own individuality and idiosyncrasies and freedom into some structure where most people can perceive us as normal. And so if you think of any therapy as trying to make people normal, it sounds very restrictive, and that it denies the basic human dignity and freedom of an individual to be who he is or they are, whatever. I would hope that the main goal for music therapy is to provide a person with another possibility of being themselves. And in addition to that, providing them with a new alternative for themselves, that at any one point in time, we are not all that we can be. So that therapy, in a sense, is a twofold process. First, can we be everything that we already have potential for? And then to what extent can we develop our potential to be even more? And when I say that, you know, music organizes experiences, it not only organizes, but it also frees those experiences. And in the freeing of those experiences, I think what happens is that people begin to realize that they have a new self, that they can be something other, that there are lots of cracks and crevices and corners within their self that they haven't fully explored, and that as they experience more feelings and experience more things with other people, they begin to understand more about themselves, and they begin to understand that they do have more potential, they can be more. And so that ultimately the purpose of therapy for me is to expand one's possibilities for being who they are, and also to provide new alternatives.
Can you give us some sense of how much change you have seen music therapy allow within the clients you've worked with? I mean, how dramatic has the effects of music therapy been?
Well, I think if we take in the area of communication, I think probably this would serve as the best example. I think probably most music therapists in this country have, if they've worked with children who are non-communicative, have had an experience where that nonverbal, resistant child who does not want to interact, who does not want to communicate with you, if they're put within a musical environment, and if their own musicality is nurtured and reinforced and rewarded, they all of a sudden do become communicative human beings. Again, not in the verbal sense, perhaps yet, but they're freed in a sense from their isolation. That they have found a medium, they found a modality. I think that's probably the greatest and most exciting kind of change that you see, is that they don't have the same need to stay isolated within themselves, that they have finally found some way of establishing contact with someone else and allowing somebody else to establish contact with them. I think that's the most dramatic change, that's most exciting.
When you are in a music therapy session, how do you go about choosing on that day with those clients what you're going to play and what their role in it is going to be?
Okay.
I mean, like, do you have a, you know, when you go to a performance, you know, beforehand, you know, well, you know, I'll start off with this piece, we'll, you know, take short intermission, I'll play that piece in a music therapy session. I don't know if you go in prepared or if you go in free to pick up on what you meet when you get in there.
That's a very interesting question. It's both, and that's probably the real skill of a therapist is exactly the question that you're asking. For some children, you always start with all children where they are. For the hyperactive child, or for the very anxious child, you might want to start with a structure that's very predictable to them, that they relate to, so that you would have things very neatly planned. You would eventually want to get out of that, but you would have to start with providing them with some kind of structure that they can relate to, so that their behavior can be put within a mold or a framework which they can find their own controls. On the other hand, with some children who don't respond to their environment, who you just have a great difficulty getting anything out of, you would try anything and you would go very freely to pick up on every single little thing that they do to make it into something engaging.
Is it, you know, in film, composers are hired to write soundtracks that are very sympathetic with the visual elements of mm-hmm. the film, that somehow describe it or evoke the mood that we're seeing. Can that be compared at all to what you as a music therapist do in trying to, like, describe the mood of a person that you're working with, and through that description helping to communicate on a certain
yes.
plane?
Yes. Again, you go back to the same difficulty. Sometimes the kind of music that you want to choose is the kind of alternative that child needs. And on the other hand, sometimes you choose the music or you make up the music to completely describe and provide a medium for that child to grow out of, so that that, again, is one of the greatest skills of the music therapist is in making the music that fits the child's needs, so that you have to really base it upon some understanding of the child that you get from some kind of an assessment when you begin. I usually like to begin by allowing the child to go into a music situation and have him choose, have many things available to him, observe very carefully what he chooses, how he uses it, the kinds of sounds that he makes. And as you observe that over a period of time, you begin to discover what possibilities he doesn't recognize that he has, and also what alternatives he doesn't have. That with disturbed children, for instance, you'll find very often that they're locked into rhythm patterns, that they will repeat rhythm patterns over and over and over again. You cannot get them out of those rhythm patterns. That, in a sense, defines their existence as being in that one track, and so that eventually you'll want to provide them with a new rhythm, with a new option. So the whole approach that you take to therapy is based upon very careful observation over a continuing period of time.
Let's listen to another of the Edith Boxall sessions to get more of a sense of what happens at a music therapy session. We're going to be hearing a session that she led with the song Go to Sleep. Ken, before we hear this, can you give us a sense of what's going on?
Yes. I think that this particular selection gives you the contrast that we're talking about. If you compare this with the first piece that you heard, the very rousing and engaging horror, you'll now hear in this piece the kind of sound that describes how a child feels on the opposite end of the continuum. When a child needs to be calmed, when a child needs to feel some security and peace and serenity, and that their responses, even within this song, you will find, are not forced. They're not purposefully elicited by her. They're free to respond how they want, but they have the structure there of a certain feeling tone, and you'll see how she leads this through to a very calming close. It's the direct opposite of the horror.
Okay, let's listen to the session conducted by Edith Boxall.
Go to sleep, my dear. Go to sleep, my darling. Go to sleep, my dear.
We've heard a recording of a music therapy session that was led by Edith Boxhill. I'm in the studio with Ken Brucia, who is the coordinator of the music therapy program at Temple University, and we've been talking about music therapy. Ken, you were talking about how music helps nonverbal children to organize their experience. It helps them to experience. It gives them different alternatives of things to experience and ways to experience. I'd like to just compare that for a minute with what you did before, which was while you were a concert pianist, also give lessons to, quote, healthy children, or healthy children.
Adults.
Don't need adults, okay. And when you're giving lessons to adults, I mean, you criticize, you evaluate, you say, well, you know, your tempo needs a little work. You've got the notes right, but put some expression into it or something. When you're working with nonverbal children who are participating within this musical experience, do you criticize or evaluate them? What kind of feedback do you give them, and how far do you allow yourself to go in making judgments, particularly judgments that they might recognize you are making?
Well, I think probably if I had any recriminations about what I've done in the past, it might be very much what we're talking about, and that is that in a music therapy situation, you learn that to criticize or to say, no, that's not the right tempo, no, that's not the right way to do this, it's not the right way to do that, you're going after the wrong thing. You're going after all the external kinds of non-essentials. What I found now as I look back in teaching and in working in therapy is that what you really have to get the individual to do is to feel something. And if they feel it, it will come out. When you teach piano students, you can tell them change tempos. You can tell them go slower, go faster, put your pedal down, play louder, play softer. But if they don't capture the essence of that phrase, if they don't capture the meaning and the feeling of what's there in the music, it will sound artificial, stilted, and still won't convey anything. So the challenge of teaching in a private situation like that is still, how do I get the individual to experience the feeling that's in those sounds, in that phrase? And it's the same thing in music therapy. You can work to manipulate speed, but you don't tell somebody that they've got the wrong speed. You may work with speed to get them to experience what you want them to experience. But basically, there's no wrong and there's no right. It makes sense or it doesn't make sense. It's either communicative or non-communicative. It's either expressive or non-expressive.
Could you compare the kinds of inhibitions? This is a strange question. I'll tell you that now. I mean, anyone, I think, when they're learning a form of music or learning practically anything, brings to that experience a certain amount of preconceptions, perhaps fears and inhibitions. Do you think that there's a different quality of inhibition that the clients who you work with who are autistic, nonverbal, bring to their music experiences than do the adults, for instance, who you were teaching classical piano style mm-hmm. to before did?
That's an interesting question. I think the difference I have seen is that, quote, normal people have this terrible fear of failure. And in a sense, that they're more inhibited. They're less expressive because they somehow have to match that norm of all the other normal people. And certainly if you're in a music school, you have so many levels of competition and you're being evaluated in so many ways that the student really feels very pressured. And so that the creative experience becomes very difficult because they have all these external concerns. With a handicapped child or adult, in a sense, I have found that their desire to make music is more native. It's more raw. It's more there. They're not afraid of making a mistake. I think more the problem you have with the handicapped population is it's almost as if they understand how revealing music is on a real personal level. And so sometimes if they don't want to interact with you, if they don't want to come into a personal contact with you, they will withhold their music from you. Normal people don't even think about it because they're so busy thinking about whether or not they've executed it correctly or not. But ultimately, music is a very revealing kind of experience. And normal people sometimes miss the boat. You know?
Yeah, I think that normal people also know that. And that can easily contribute to the inhibition because you know what you're playing is revealing. And if you're self-conscious, you know what it is you would want to and not want to reveal.
Right.
And that's a cycle that I imagine handicapped children need not get into, or perhaps they would, I don't know.
It's hard to know for sure what they're really thinking or afraid of sometimes.
I think that a lot of what you're saying would have really wonderful application in public schools, to the teaching of normal children in music classes.
There is a trend now, and it's called aesthetic education. And that trend basically is very consistent with what I'm talking about. It basically goes after having the child experience music, and many of the artificial things that people think are music are not music. Writing and learning how to read notation and learning what a whole note and a half note is isn't music. It's something about music. Aesthetic education goes more at experiencing a whole note and a half note, not knowing necessarily what the label is or how to write it, but can one experience that and produce it? That's more, I think, also very consistent with music therapy, because certainly handicapped children, you're not going to ask to notate what they've done or to follow a notation system.
I think what you're saying also has application to music listeners, audience, who approach a concert often with a certain set of preconceptions of what they should hear and what's good and what's bad and what's, musical and what's not
yes.
musical.
It's amazing. I suppose what we eventually don't accept from others in terms of their individual freedom in their musical expression, it will eventually recoil on us, and we will also be very hard on ourselves in terms of demanding that things only be done in this way, and that's not where music is.
There are some very avant-garde jazz sessions that John Coltrane mm-hmm. and,
yeah.
and a lot of others participated in that a lot of people, when hearing it, particularly for the first time, react by saying, that's crazy, and it's really, it's a very powerful and often very frightening experience to first be exposed to that. And images of what we call crazy people, I think, often pops mm-hmm. into people's minds when they hear those sessions. Can you talk at all about if you think like the power of that music has any kind of comparison to either the music that's used in music therapy or the music that is made in therapy sessions?
Well, I don't want to make any comment about Coltrane. But I think what I would like to say is that music can be disordered, which may sound like a contradiction, but disturbed children, disturbed people, all right, when they express themselves, sometimes it comes out as if it's not readily perceivable to other people as ordered. It may very well be a very accurate description of where they are and where what they're feeling. And part of the thing I think about a music therapist is that what they would go after is accepting that, but at the same time, seeing whether or not that person needs some kind of order. That person may be desperately reaching out. Something like the jazz improvisations, I think, are very highly ordered. I think probably the listener, because it is so improvisational, the listener sometimes can't grasp what that order is. But I think the improvisational mode of expression itself is so free and it's so expressive that many times it is so peculiar to a person that other people can't really understand it. And so you try and hark back to say, well, what, was there some kind of an organization in melody? Was there some kind of an organization in harmony? And maybe that's not what was being organized at all. Maybe it was feelings. Maybe it was the kinds of experiences that followed each other. So it's very difficult to really, you have to be like on every different level to really understand somebody else's musical offering. And accept it and still see whether or not there's some other alternative that they should have.
Mm-hmm. What has been done with the avant-garde of jazz is that there has, you know, there is now a school of music criticism and a certain amount of history which has allowed people to separate in their own minds the good avant-garde, crazed jazz musicians from the ones who were just being, you know, fairly imitative and maybe expressing a state peculiar to them, but not expressing it in perhaps a very interesting or... See, here I am making judgments again. I just find this really interesting, like when judgments are placed on music and when they're not placed on music, when to come with an accepting mind and an open mind and when to pass judgment upon things. And somehow I think the work that you're doing is somehow... Mm.
I suppose it's the answer to that question is the answer to the question that probably all men seek an answer to, and that is when do I pass judgment on another human being and when do I not? Because it's one and the same thing. I find it interesting that you're bringing up jazz. Because what I keep thinking of is that jazz, the history of jazz, has been such a struggle for the jazz musician. When jazz first started, I mean, they attributed so many evil spirits to jazz, and jazz was seen as such a negative influence that it could even, I was reading, I can't even remember, I think it was in an anthropology book, the effect of jazz on the culture was like, you know, the culture was warning everybody, if you continue to listen to this, you're going to decay, you're going to really go bad, I mean, you're really going to go sour. And it's amazing because, I mean, it is probably one of the most beautiful and sophisticated art forms that we have today. And on top of it all, I see it as one of the most important trends because it has revived improvisation and it has given back the world of music, the individual, and what the individual expresses as being his. And so that's why this whole value thing, I think, comes up. I think jazz has really pointed it out more than many other spheres of musical endeavors in our culture.
What you're saying is really very interesting. Let's, Ken, go back to the Edith Boxall session and listen to another recording from this session. We're going to hear something that she did with the song This Little Light, a song that you're probably familiar with. Ken, do you want to say a few words about this session we're going
yes,
to hear?
Yes, I think that this particular activity gives you an idea of if you wanted to use music to go after some kind of verbal or speech skill, you can. I think she's going after a couple of things in this. She's going after articulation, and she's also going after improving their understanding of words. She's increasing their vocabulary, and at the same time, she's motivating them to speak it and to say it correctly. Within a musical situation, children will find this much more rewarding than if they were in a room in which there was no other reason for being in that room than to talk. In a musical situation, they'll talk much freelier, much more freely, and have a good time.
Okay, let's hear it.
Do you see the light? Light, point to it. Oh, good, good, dear Paul. Josh, way up the light. Light.
Mm-hmm. Light.
Light.
Not too.
Yes.
Here. About
here. Excuse me.
This what? Little light dog.
I cannot sing it for him.
You can't, what, dear?
I can't sing it for him.
You can't sing it for
she
him?
She says she's going to.
Very good. That's good. All right. Let's
May
do it together.
Sing
Let's
it?
Start again. One,
two, three. Begin.
Begin. Now, this little light. Light, point to the light. Light, way up there.
No.
Very good.
Here.
This little
light.
Light of
no.
And the light is
I'm gonna let it shine. This little
light.
Point to the light. Where's the light? Light. Good.
Light.
Light of
mine.
No,
I'm gonna let it
shh.
Carl?
Shh.
This little. Where's the light? Where's the light? Way up there. Way up, yes.
Pull up
the light, Josh.
Never.
Light. Light, Josh.
Light.
Light.
No.
Good. Light of
no.
mine. I'm gonna let it shine. Let it clap. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. I didn't hear you. Let it shine. Let it shine.
Shine.
Let it shine.
Let it shine.
Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let now everywhere I go. Now we're going to make our arms go all around the room. Everybody, all around the room, and you're going to go everywhere, all around this room.
Oh,
yes, Paul, that's wonderful. Very good. Yes. Carl, Joyce, are you going to dance and go all around the room, show the way the words of the song go? All around the room.
Edith Boxhill, that's a session that she led in Music Therapy, which is recorded on the Folkways label. If you're just joining us now, I'm in the studio with Ken Brucia, who is a music therapist and the coordinator of the Music Therapy program at Temple University. Well, Ken, we've spent some time talking very abstractly about music therapy. Can you just, you know, briefly tell us specifically some of the places now that are using music therapy and for what kinds of people?
Yes, it's a very, very growing profession. right now, music therapists are really employed in almost every kind of clinical setting, dealing with every client population you can think of, all the way from drug abuse to forensic psychiatry to mental retardation, learning disabilities, adults, children in geriatric facilities, in nursing homes. There, throughout the country, there are more and more music therapists that are being used. It is becoming more and more of a viable profession. Right now, we have two organizations representing the profession, and we have certification and registration in the field. There are approximately 50 or 60 schools in this country offering undergraduate and graduate degrees in music therapy. So it is really it has arrived. It is here. We need more research. We need a lot more professional work done yet. But certainly, it's a thriving profession now.
Ken, in your experiences as a music therapist, what do you hope that you've left people with, who you've worked with? What have been the powerful experiences for you?
Oh, well, that's a very difficult question. I think probably if I've worked with someone and left them just with a new discovery about themselves, about how they can relate to the world if they choose, if I've given them more freedom to be themselves, that might sound abstract, but I think in the long run, so many therapists in the various kinds of therapies go so strong after insisting that somebody change to the way you want them to change. And I suppose every therapist at one time or another does that. But I would rather not say that I have left a client with the behavior that I wanted to leave them with. I hope that what I leave them with is an opportunity or possibility to be all something more than what they were when they first started with me. And that may be even high in the sky, but that's what I would hope for. And I would, the most pleasant experiences that I've had is when I've really sensed that, when I've ended with a client and saw that they've got now, they have music, and that gives them an access to themselves.
You are using music in a very powerful way. It is almost a literal description of what we say about art. It communicates on an abstract plane and opens us up for experiences that would otherwise have been unexpressible, unavailable. Are you aware of that at sessions? I mean, just...
Yes, because I think that the music therapy session has to be an experience for both people. If it has to be an experience for the client, it has to be an experience for the therapist. And the therapist who uses music in that context to engage both people and to capture the experience of both people is not only having a wonderful time, but they're also hopefully doing some good.
Ken Brucia, I want to thank you enormously for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Ken Brucia. He is a music therapist. He is the coordinator of the music therapy program at Temple University. We're going to close this interview with another recording from the Edith Boxall sessions.
Now, we're going to clap and sing. Guantanamera. Again? Guantanamera. 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 Good. Then later, yes, we'll do that again, and then we're going to come in all together. Yes, we're going to play our instruments together. You do like it? Oh, I'm glad you like it, Florence. Now.
And like the whole song.
Good. That's very good. Mm-hmm. All right.
This
now I'm going to say one, two, three. Go. Guantanamera. 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 Guantanamera.
We're going to take turns on the instruments alone. Each one is going to play an instrument alone, like this. Guantanamera. Yes. Each one will take a turn, and then we'll all come in together. Ready? Florence? Guantanamera. Very good. Now, Carl? Guantanamera. Good. All right. Joyce. Guantanamera. Very good. And Gilbert. Guantanamera. Fine. Now, everybody.